Say, kids, what time is it? It's time for another episode of Brio TV, the podcast. I'm your host, Bill Brio. This episode is brought to you by CTV, Hollywood Suite, Paramount Plus, and Super Channel.
Express yourself.
My guest today is an award-winning filmmaker and the driving force behind some of the most heralded documentaries of the past 40-plus years. Titles such as Shake Hands with the Devil, The Journey of Romeo Dallaire, and Genius Within, The Inner Life of Glenn Gould, are among the many films he has produced. This veteran filmmaker has been busier than ever with two projects which were just awarded with multiple Canadian Screen Award nominations. They are Buffy St. Marie, Carry It On, and Unloved, Huronia's Forgotten Children. He's also just teamed with director Robbie Hart, a previous podcast guest, on Icebreaker, the 72 Summit series, now streaming on Super Channel. Please welcome a man who has seen more corners of Canada than a Chinese weather balloon, the president of White Pine Pictures, Peter Raymond. Thank you for doing this today. Appreciate it. I know you're very busy.
Sure. Well, I just drove from Ottawa. I drove up yesterday and back this morning. But the highway was good.
That was some weather, though, you must have encountered.
Not really. I was lucky. It snowed overnight. We didn't get the snow in Toronto that you got in Toronto, in Ottawa. I drove up yesterday. There was no snow. I left early in the morning.
Well, I love the Group of Seven painting full of snow behind you. So,
well, that's Lauren Harris, of course.
Of course, yeah.
And, Nancy Lang and I made a film about Lauren Harris.
I know. Yeah.
His spiritual journey.
Yeah, I live near the center in I'm in Brampton, so. We visited the Group of Seven gallery there in Kleinberg, I guess last summer now, but always loved that gallery. It's beautiful.
You know, when I was in Ottawa, we're less than a week from the passing of Peter Herndorf, who was almost like a second father to me. He was such a great man and cultural champion of Canada. But when I was in Ottawa yesterday, just by happenstance, I didn't know it was happening. They had a little ceremony honoring him at the National Arts Center, and I stumbled upon it, and people were weeping. Oh, it was he was such a great. Did you know Peter Herndorf?
You know, I certainly knew of him, and I met him on one or two occasions, but sadly, I did not know him. And anyone I've talked to, some colleagues who are a bit older, Ron Bass and Ray Bennett, friends like that, speak with reverence of him, and I wish I had known him better. So let's start with that. Yeah, I mean, how did you first encounter him?
Peter Herndorf. Well, he was running the CBC, really, the English side, and I was an independent documentary filmmaker, as I've been most of my life, and he was just very supportive of the work I was doing, very aware of what I was doing, and then at TVO, of course, there was a whole program created that Rudy Boutinho ran to license independently produced documentaries. And you know, we've just been in touch and had lunch, and he gives me advice, and he's very connected to Massey College, of course, where I'm now the filmmaker in residence. So, but and he would always phone me on my birthday and sing happy birthday.
That's great.
He had a good voice. He sang in a choir as a boy, and he loved to sing. And I'm sure I wasn't the only one who he sang. He must have been singing happy birthday every day to somebody.
That's fantastic.
He knew so many people, and so many people admired him and loved him.
Wow.
So he's a great loss to Canada and to Canadian culture and broadcasting and the arts.
Yeah, you don't often hear people speak glowingly of like people at that level who are I mean, they have these key administrative jobs, but his were in provinces and federal and all across the board, weren't they?
He was an extraordinary, he did so many things, right? CBC, Toronto Life Magazine, TBO, the National Arts Centre, Luminato. And he knew people all across the country in all parts of the arts and was incredibly supportive of new talent. And he got things done. He had this extraordinary ability to raise money for projects, and people trusted him, and he worked very hard.
Yeah, well, it's lovely to hear that praise for him. I'm speaking, of course, with Peter Raymond. And it's Raymond. Is that, am I pronouncing it the French way? Is that right? Or do you?
Well, no, most people say Raymond.
You Raymond. Know, okay.
Got a T on the end. It's unusual.
No, I my name is Brieu, and I mispronounce it as Brio. So I always have to check. You know, that's
that a type of brush you use for cleaning your dishes.
Yeah. Well, it was like the Italian soft drink too, right? You know. Sorry. When I was a student at University of Toronto, when I was registering, the professor there, Gino Matteo, who was a great friend, he was head of the film program there for a while. But I remember when he was signing me in, he goes, Brio, your name has an effervescent quality. never forget that. Listen, so much to talk about. We spoke most recently at the Hockey Hall of Fame, where we were treated to a screening of Icebreaker, the 72 Summit series. This is a great documentary. People listening, if you haven't had a chance, look it up. My goodness. It was, of course, the Hockey Summit series, the greatest sporting event in my lifetime. That was a great event at the hall. You had Yvonne Cornway there, many, many people, the great illustrator, political cartoonist, Aislinn. Oh my God, you know, some of my heroes. So congratulations on a fine documentary there, first of all.
Peter. Thank you. It's really Robbie Hart's documentary. He was the director. It was his idea. I was the support staff. I, as I often am these days, I'm the executive producer. I raise the money. I worry about getting it done on time and on budget. And I keep in touch with the broadcasters and the financiers. And so that's more and more my role.
Well, Peter, I mean, let's be frank. That is a role of a miracle maker in Canada these days. You know, I mean, I honestly, I don't, I'm joking a bit, but I don't want to downplay. It's so hard to do that, you know, to get something. It's a miracle to get a television show made or a movie, documentary, and you've done it many, many, many times, you know. So congratulations on a wonderful career with some really important works.
Thanks, Bill. Well, you know, my little company, we started it in 1978 when I moved here from Montreal after working at the NFB for 7 years, where I learned so much from the giants of documentary.
And that was in Montreal, Peter?
Yeah, the film board in Montreal. They hired me right out of university. I was 21 years old. I knew nothing. I'd made a couple of student documentaries and student films, and they gave me a job as an editor for 3 months, and I stayed there for 7 years.
And when you talk an editor, it was you behind a big Steinbeck or something?
Yeah, the Steinbeck, that's right.
Yeah.
And the movie Ola before that. It was just in that I joined the film board just as they were kind of shifting over from Moviolas to Steinbeck. So I loved the Steinbeck and the old guillotine splicer where
yes.
You pull the tape across and pull down.
Yeah.
I had my pet guillotines. I practically slept with that. You become very attached to your tools.
Well, I know something of that. I collect 16 millimeter film. I still have a basement full of stuff, and I have a couple of old little metal Italian guillotine splicers, and you're right, you value them, and you worry once the blades are dull who's going to sharpen them, but you don't get anywhere without them. So we're talking about film then. What was this first student documentary you made at Queen's that got everything started?
I made two films at Queen's. One was called Blue, which was actually more of an experimental film. That was my first. Remember 8mm, Super 8, regular 8?
Yeah.
Magnetic Edge Stripe. And that was a film about blue, the color, blue, the emotion. And of course, you could use any music in your films when you're a student. So I had Joni Mitchell and Paul Simon music and
perfect.
A lot of beautiful scenes in the woods. But then I made a film called Have You Ever Been North of Princess Street, which I'm pretty quick. I don't know if you know Kingston, but it's very much divided, or it was. North of Princess are people often living in many on welfare, and south of Princess are the doctors and the lawyers and the students and the Queen's University community. I don't know if it's still like that, but it was back then in 1969 and 70 when I was there. And that film helped anyway get me a job at the NFB.
Amazing. That's fantastic. So then you came to Toronto in 1978?
Yeah, I did. I drove down the highway with my girlfriend, and we bought a house for, we had $5,000 each that we'd saved.
Wow.
And that was enough to buy a 10-room home just north of Kensington Market there, you know, in the Major Street.
Now you might be able to park for that amount of money for a month somewhere.
But I was, you know, I hoped I could help make a more of a marriage of the National Film Board and the CBC, because I'd been working at the Film Board with the Film Board for 7 years, and me and my colleagues, we made a lot of, I think, quite good films, but they weren't very widely seen in Canada. They certainly weren't televised very much, and our films were kind of better known on Channel 4 and the BBC in the UK than they were in Canada. So this Film Board was just starting to regionalize at that point. They were opening offices in Toronto and Vancouver and across the West and Halifax. And so the idea of being here would be to try to bring those two institutions closer together.
Well, I know you got very involved. You know, I'll talk a bit. I was at University of Toronto, and I made a little film, and I was able to edit it on weekends. Somebody let me into the NFB office on Adelaide Street, I think, to sneak in overnights on Sundays to cut on a Steinbeck, you know?
Great.
So that were my memories of it. But, you know, you encountered this problem of getting your films seen, and you got involved in ways to make that happen, right? With the Canadian Producers Association and others?
Yeah, and we lobbied the government. You know, they Telfilm, which was called the Canadian Film Development Corporation at the time, started funding documentaries for the first time. And then a little later on, the Ontario government created the Ontario Media Development Corporation, Ontario Film Development Corporation, now Ontario Creates. So these government support for films and more for documentary films were just getting started in those days.
And at what point, I know you were, I think, in the first graduating class of the Canadian Film Center. Which
I was, that's right, 1988.
Okay, so
Norman Jewison.
Yeah, Norman Jewison, eh? Okay.
Yeah, that was great.
Was Christina Jennings also in that first class?
Does
that
No, this was Anne Medina and there were Bob Hunter from Greenpeace.
Oh, wow, wow.
And Holly Dale, and there were wonderful people in that first group. John Gunn. Anyway, we were
Holly Dale was a great director, still directing.
Sure, I think. Yeah.
Hookers on Davy, I think, at different films back then. Wow. So that was, it must have been a very exciting time.
It was. We were all going to be the next, revolution of Canadian feature filmmakers. That was the idea.
Well, it seems to have paid off, Peter. You went on to make some fantastic movies. Let's talk about some of those. This Icebreaker film, you did something called The New Ice Age back many years ago as well on the business of hockey, right?
Yeah, it was behind the scenes, The New Ice Age, A Year in the Life of the NHL. It was a 6-hour series behind the scenes in hockey. I like to make films that are behind the scenes, whether it's in politics, which many of my films are, or in the media. I've done quite a few films about, you know, inside the world of journalism and reportage in Nicaragua and in Canada and elsewhere. I did several films about politics behind the scenes with Flora McDonald, with Bill Davis when he was premier.
Wow.
I like making films that take people into places they wouldn't be able to get normally, right?
Okay, so that's the answer to the next question. Like, what was the fascination of being behind the scenes? In terms of Bill Davis, you know, when I was growing up, going to school, he was the Minister of Education and the Premier. And I live in Brampton, which is Brampton Billy Davis, right? And Flora McDonald, cabinet minister for the Tories. What was the fascination with politics then for you?
Well, you know, I'm a child of the 60s, so we were, my generation were very much involved in political action, trying to stop the war in Vietnam, civil rights movement, the women's movement. And so many people in my years at school and university became journalists and writers. And I volunteered for Trudeau in 68 when he was running for the leader of the Liberal Party. That convention was very exciting. I was there.
Oh, my goodness. Let me stop you there. So it was at April of 68.
Yeah.
I remember as
a... Were you there too?
No, I was 11. no, wait a minute. 68, I would have been, born in 57. So, but I remember being just glued to it on television. It was like the greatest reality show I've ever seen.
It was very exciting. Yeah.
That moment when Judy LaMarche was telling the other guys, we got to stop this bastard.
They got a microphone in on her.
Yeah.
So that type of stuff made me feel, wow, wouldn't it be great to make a documentary behind the scenes at a leadership convention?
Yeah.
In 76, I did that with Flora, who I'd known at Queen's University. She was running the politics department under John Basil. She'd left the Progressive Conservative Party and Diefenbaker and moved to Kingston and was there. And when she decided to run for election in Kingston and then later run for the leader of the leadership, she let me inside her campaign.
Fascinating to me, you know, and you're a little bit older than I am, but just old enough to have been on the cusp of all that stuff that was happening in the late 60s. You could have gone to Woodstock, I presume, you know, that kind of stuff, right?
Sure. No, that was a fantastic time to be alive.
Yeah.
Be a teenager in the 60s, that's for sure.
Yeah. When you think of people like John and Yoko going to Ottawa to see Trudeau, you know, and incredible, really.
We all felt we could have an impact. We could change the world in some way. You know, there was so much of a spirit of, you know, even though, you know, the death of the Kennedys and the death of Martin Luther King and the Vietnam War, there was horrific things happening. But somehow we our generation had that spirit that we could somehow create change and make the world a better place. And at the film board, they had this whole unit called Challenge for Change. You kind of made films to try to change social policy.
Well, it's fascinating to me because right now, and you're a documentary film producer, so many documentaries are based in 1970, 71, 72. You recently did one, of course, Buffy St. Marie was one of the great towering figures of the 60s and that era. I just watched last night on TV a documentary on Bill Russell from the NBA. Have you seen that?
I haven't seen it, but I'd love to, yeah.
Oh, my goodness. You know, it's that whole, because of the activism and the, you know, race relations, he was right in the middle of everything and standing up for Muhammad Ali and everything else. It must make your head spin to see, literally, you cannot turn on a streaming channel without seeing a Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young documentary. Or, you know what I mean? It's very current, isn't it?
I'm very proud of the film that opened the Toronto Film Festival 3 years ago. It was called Once We're Brothers, Robbie Robertson and the Band.
Yeah.
It was directed by this youngster called Daniel Rohr, who was 24 years old at the time. And now, touch wood, he's going to win the Oscar for Navalny, you know? He's up for the Oscar for Best Documentary. And he's just this 20-something kid from Toronto here who's has this rocket-like career. It's wonderful. And that was his big, sort of first big film was our Robbie Robertson film 3 years ago. You know,
Incredible. Yeah, which is a great documentary. Crave shows it quite a bit, and as they should. We'll be back in a moment with Peter Raymond. What's new for February from our friends at Super Channel? Well, for one, check out the new true crime docuseries called Friends Speak. Now, this has nothing to do with Joey or Monica or Chandler Bing. Each episode of Friends Speak airs as a 90-minute true crime documentary and brings you the unique perspective of the people who were friends with notorious criminals or their victims. Hear firsthand accounts of the days leading up to and the days after some of the world's most notorious crimes, including Casey Anthony, Jodi Arias, Chris and Shannon Watts, Natalie Holloway, and the House of Horrors family. New episodes of Friends Speak air weekly as part of Super Channel's Friday Night True Crime Block, or can be viewed anytime on Super Channel On Demand. Remember, Super Channel is available via most cable providers right across the country, as well as streaming live and on demand with Amazon Prime Video channels and Apple TV Plus. Have you been watching season 2 of the Paramount Plus drama Mayor of Kingstown? I just had co-creator Hugh Dillon on as a podcast guest, and Hugh talked about basing the Prison Town series on his own hometown of Kingston, Ontario. Parts of season 1 were even shot at a decommissioned prison in that Canadian city. Now here's some good news if you're a Paramount Plus subscriber. The streaming service has just picked up the rights to a series that helped make Dillon an actor to watch several years ago in Canada, Durham County. The series ran from 2007 to 2010 and also starred a couple of great Canadian actresses, Helen Joy from Murdoch Mysteries and Lawrence LaBeouf from Transplant. Dillon played Detective Mike Sweeney on Durham County. He's on the hunt from a serial killer who he may have a strong connection to way back from his past. Adrian Mitchell, who went on to executive produce CBC's Coroner, was the co-creator of this eerie series, which frankly was years ahead of its time. Check out Durham County, available toward the end of February, and also watch Mayor of Kingston, all streaming in February on Paramount Plus. Here he is again, Peter Raymond. I know that you're very active in mentoring even young documentary filmmakers. You have established a fund in the name of your late wife, Linda Lee Tracy. That this is presented, I believe, annually at the Hot Docs Festival, right?
That's right. Linda Lee passed away 16 years ago. She was a great writer and an extraordinary filmmaker, very passionate about what she did, really a brilliant writer. And very sad to lose her at age 49 from breast cancer. Mm. So our son was just 16 when she passed. And so we created this prize in her honor that each year we present to an emerging Canadian filmmaker who has the spirit of Linda Lee, both her spirit of social justice and who all, they also have to have a sense of humor.
Good. That's a great, I'm glad to hear that asterisk, Peter, because often it's missing, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, Linda Lee sure had a great sense of humor.
Can you give me an example?
Well, you know, when she was young, she was a burlesque dancer, and she did it all as a kind of spoof on the whole art. And she made an extraordinary series called The Anatomy of Burlesque, 3-hour film series. She did a film on Bhopal, the great tragedy in India. She made a film about her father, who she never knew, Abby, I Hardly Knew Ya, which was one of the first films commissioned by TVO when they started that whole strand of POV documentaries when Rudy was there and Peter Herndorf.
That's great. My goodness, so much to talk about. I want to talk also, obviously, Shake Hands with the Devil, such a towering work. The journey of Romeo Dallaire, I believe, is the general who you found him, went back to Rwanda. It's a really, really tremendous documentary. Congratulations on that.
Before we leave Linda Lee, if you don't mind for a second, I mean, she, just before she passed, she was part of a team that created a drama series called The Border. And I was very proud of this series. It was really her inspiration. And we did it. We did 38 episodes over 3 years for the CBC. James McGowan, Graham Abbey, Grace Park, Jonas Jetchik. It was a wonderful series.
Yeah.
Had huge, very large viewership on CBC. David Barlow and Janet McLean were the writers, but it was really Linda Lee's inspiration that created that series.
Well, Peter, I think that's where we met. I went. I was writing probably for the Toronto Sun at the time, and went down to location at the foot of Toronto. You guys were shooting in what used to be like the ferry dock for the ferry line that went to Syracuse or Rochester.
Rochester,
right? Yeah. It was a perfect setting for a. If you had to build one, you could have done a better job, right? For
a great building. It was the old port. The ferry port, and it was kind of not being used anymore. Yeah. They'd stopped that ferry, so we were able to get that building and use it as the headquarters of this fictitious Canadian security squad that was minding the border.
Yeah, it. I love the show, and it was three seasons. Catherine Disher, right?
Yeah, Kathy Disher was in it.
Very funny.
Sophia Milos from CSI, who played the Homeland Security officer that they had to deal with. We had a lot of fun with that show.
Yeah. I remember Sophia Milos winning like the, you know, Icon Award at Banff or something.
Yes.
And I just thought, well, really? A lovely actress on this show. I just didn't strike me up there with some of the other icons, you know. But good for her. But James McCowan, tell me what are your thoughts about this? It's only in Canadian television can you have a guy who's the lead of a series and is tremendous in that role, and then sort of. That opportunity doesn't come around again as it would if he had been the lead of an American series. It seems to me, you know, you'll see the same guy who's lead on CSI something or other 4 years later on another American network show. Is it just because the Canadian television system does not offer enough opportunities for careers?
No, there aren't enough opportunities. And James was terrific. He was the leader of that team. You know, he won awards at the Monte Carlo Television Festival for his role in The Border. That series was sold all over the world, did very well for us and for the CBC. But you're right. People like James, Graham Abbey's extraordinary actor,
yeah,
who is
yeah.
in Stratford and is now back and doing stuff in Stratford. They never really did another yet. I have not yet done another drama series like that. We did another series after that a few years later called Cracked with David Sutcliffe.
Remember it, yeah.
It was about the intersection of policing and mental illness. And that went for two seasons on the CBC. So I keep trying to get another series going, drama series, and keep pitching them and developing them, and hopefully we will. But in the meantime, I'm making lots of documentaries.
You sure are. Dennis McGrath was the writer on
That's right.
The Border at the time.
Oh, yeah, we lost him, sadly.
He was very young when he died. What is it? Is Canada at a crossroads? All this, you know, the talk of a new broadcast act and changes, new bills in front of Parliament. Are things going in the right direction, Peter, in terms of really?
Well, I hope so. I mean, I think there's a lot of hope about C-11 injecting a lot more money into the system. Mm-hmm. Bill C-11 is this bill in front of Parliament that will essentially tax the streamers, Netflix, Disney Plus, Paramount Plus, all these streamers that have started up and have opened offices just in the last year in Canada to commission Canadian shows. And of course, now, apart from pitching the CBC and Bell Media and Rogers and Corus, we're now pitching these new streamers. We used to, I used to have to go to LA to pitch Netflix. Now you can pitch them in Toronto. So hopefully that will result in a lot more Canadian production.
Certainly, Prime Video has been commissioning a few shows lately that have looked promising and are based in Canada and featuring right. and starring Canadians. So you're right. Hopefully that's the direction. Oh my God.
Talk about a lot of stuff, Bill. I've been doing this for 52 years, so I've witnessed I've witnessed a lot of changes in the Canadian television landscape, that's for sure.
What keeps the fire burning, Peter? I mean, you know, this stuff, every time you make one of these, you've made like just in the last 18 months, four big projects or more, I think, right? I mean, you must have a few on the go now.
Right now we're in production on a very important film about microplastics and their effect on human health. And we're doing it with TELUS. It's a new initiative of TELUS to commission documentary features. So that's exciting. It's fun to be in on the ground level of new initiatives in broadcasting. We're also doing shows with Super Channel, who are back on their feet. But the microplastics film is going to be fantastic. Syed Tong and Ben Edelman and Vanessa Dillon, Rick Smith. And there are frightening new discoveries almost every month now on revelations from scientific studies on how microplastics are affecting human health, getting into our blood and our brains and our hearts.
Lungs and everything.
Yeah. Oh my God.
What, like for example, a microplastic that you might consume in processed food or?
Yeah. Processed food, that we drink too many of these bottles of water in plastic bottles and plastic packaging. There's a lot of plastics in the clothes we wear. So that has to be addressed. Who knows what impact it has had, all these tiny shards of plastic, over the last few decades. And it's only plastic's really only a post World War II product, right?
Yeah.
It didn't exist much before then, and it's taken over the world.
It sort of peaked and reached a point where everything you had tried to open, you had needed scissors to break through the plastic, right?
Remember that great line in The Graduate with Dustin Hoffman? I have one thing to say to you, boy. Plastics.
That's right. You mentioned Super Channel. They're actually a sponsor of this podcast.
Yes.
Can you talk specifically about anything coming up?
Well, they've been a great supporter of our films. They were involved in the Icebreaker film that you mentioned earlier.
Yeah, that's right. The
Russia 72 hockey series. Several other of our three other films made by Fred Peabody, All Governments Lie and The Corporate Coup d'Etat. They're terrific people to work with. Don McDonald in Edmonton and Jackie Party, who's their commissioner. Don came to Whistler for the screening of the Icebreaker film there. So
that's nice.
We're always pitching new ideas to them.
They host Canadian film festivals now, right on Super Channel. People can watch virtually, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty exciting. Yeah. I think I mentioned to you that I would be asking three questions. Uh-oh. So if you don't mind, that I ask everybody these three. So you being involved in television, what are you watching now? What's caught your interest? Are you binging anything TV-wise?
Oh, boy. I don't. I wish I had more time to watch more television. I'm so busy and I do a lot of reading. And I'm probably dating myself, but I love Succession. It's still going.
Yeah.
I think it's a great, great series. Brian Cox, the great Scottish actor who I actually met at the International Emmy Awards last year when we were down there with our film Toxic Beauty. I watch religiously 60 Minutes, and I have forever, I guess.
Yeah.
What I watch is Jeopardy. I mean, that yes, I do.
Of course.
I'm dating myself, but you remember when Mateo Roach went for 23 games?
Yes. Oh, yeah. You can't look away. It's fantastic. Oh,
my God. That was fantastic.
Where do you stand on the two hosts of Jeopardy?
I'd watch The West Wing forever, all the reruns. I think that was one of my favorite television shows of all time.
Are you a Ken Jennings fan? Which host of Jeopardy is the
I like Ken Jennings. I mean, you can never replace Alex, you know, but no. I think Ken's good. He's sharp. He's got a good sense of humor.
Yeah, no, I like him too. And I mean, you talk about Jeopardy being revealing your age, but we live in a time when you can watch anything that ever aired ever on television if you are on the right platform, right? Like, yes. I caught myself watching The Beverly Hillbillies on Tubi.
Oh my God.
I realized I'd just gone too far down the rabbit hole. But there it is.
Is that your favorite song? From
what's
an old
that?
TV show, The Beverly Hillbillies.
Oh, my theme song. Okay, well, let's ask
that. I know you're supposed to be asking me the questions, but
no, I couldn't
resist.
I'll tell you, my favorite is the original, and this changes all the time, but you remember the old British series, The Avengers, with Patrick McNee? And I just thought that stirring orchestral theme to that one is pretty amazing. It really kicked off the next hour of adventure for me. And of course, Diana Rigg didn't hurt either. But do you have a favorite TV theme song from the past?
You know, I love the William Tell Overture that was the theme song of The Lone Ranger, of Jay Silverheels as Tonto. And I watched that as a little kid, and I just loved that. My parents were into classical music. You know, they had Glenn Gould records, and we listened to a lot of classical music as kids. But so good to cut to, right?
Oh, my goodness. Well, you ended up documenting Glenn Gould recently. Yes, yeah, which wonderful film, too. But yeah, the William Tell Overture. I'll tell you a story. I actually once got to meet the actor, not Jay Silverheels, but the actor who played the Lone Ranger. Oh my goodness, trying to think of his name now, but I met him later in life when he wasn't allowed to wear the mask anymore. Somebody else was making a film about the Lone Ranger and he had to wear sunglasses. But I approached him with my tape recorder, introduced myself from Toronto, and he started talking about Silverheels and Brantford, Ontario.
Right.
He was his Kemosabe, he told me. Yeah. And then he looked at my tape recorder and he said, "Are you grinding?" And I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "Shut her down."
Oh.
And then Lone Ranger tells you to stop your tape recorder. Anyway, I digress. So the last question then, Peter, is when you were a youngster, what was your favorite TV show?
Oh, I had many, you know. I'm sure you did too. Didn't you watch the Ed Sullivan Show every night?
Oh, yeah, with my parents.
The Wonderful World of Disney, whatever it was called, Walt Disney.
Did you see the Beatles on Ed Sullivan?
Oh, of course. Everybody did, right?
Yeah. Remember,
but I liked, there was a bizarre show. You asked me to think about this a couple of days ago. And I remembered a show, I don't think it lasted very long, it was called True, with Jack. And it was kind of documentary type programming. It took you to places, and it was a great show. You remember Jack Webb, and he walked out on this set with the words "True" in huge letters.
So this is Jack Webb from Dragnet.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't ring a bell. I don't know. This would have been going back in the 60s, I'm guessing.
You're an expert on this, Bill.
Look, I know I should know. I'm sorry. Now look, I'm going to have to find out now. But I'm starting to feel like I was trying to think of it. Was Clayton Moore was the guy who played the Lone Ranger? So now I have. So I have to look up True with Jack Webb. So that was something you watched when you were growing up. Grew up in Ottawa?
I did. I was very fortunate. It's a beautiful town for to be a kid. You know.
Yeah,
you're only 15 minutes from the Gatineau Hills, where you can go skiing and snowshoeing and hiking in the woods, and it's a beautiful place, Ottawa. I was just there earlier today, actually.
Yeah, well, you've done a lot in terms of adventure and discovering Canada. You've been up north as well, right? And exploring a bit.
I was so fortunate when I was at the NFB in my 20s. They sent me, Wolf Koenig sent me to Igloolik and to Cape Dorset to make films and teach filmmaking. Zach Kunick, you know, and Igloolik and all these youngsters were just experimenting with filmmaking for the first time. Animation from Cape Dorset and live action filmmaking as well, and with actors. I was very fortunate to get up there, and I fell in love with the Arctic and Inuit people. Many have still friends there and went back and made many films in the North. I think if I was ever the Tsar of Canada, I would make airfares really cheap for youngsters so they could travel this extraordinary country and get up to places like Igloolik and Cape Dorset and feel the spirit of the land and the people and really understand Canada.
But getting there back when you were there that in the 70s, I presume,
that
would have been quite an adventure, wouldn't it?
It was a great adventure, sure. And there weren't really hotels in these places. You'd just stay in a transit center, whatever they were called, or you'd stay at people's homes and they'd take you out hunting, caribou hunting and seal hunting and on Thumbotics with, skidoos and dog teams. And it was an extraordinary adventure. I was very, very fortunate.
Well, I've had the good fortune to get up to Yellowknife and Whitehorse, but never directly north here in Ontario. That does sound fantastic. And I love your idea of making airfares affordable for, it costs less to go to Europe than to go to St. John's. It's kind of sad in Canada, right?
Crazy. No, it's crazy. We have to. Our country, we're so fortunate to live in one of the most beautiful countries in the world, and we should see it and explore it more, especially when we're young.
Yeah, for sure. More with Peter Raymond after these messages.
You're not a dream, you're not an angel, you're a woman. I'm not a king, I'm just a man, take my hand. We'll make a space in this life that we plan.
Well, we're here again with Emily Gagné from Hollywood Suite. Emily, what do you got for us this month?
Well, Bill, we've got the last couple of episodes of The Last Movie Stars, which I know I talked to you about before. It's a 6-part docuseries about Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward, directed by Ethan Hawke, and it's really spectacular. You can watch it Thursday nights at 9 p.m. Through February 16th, so right around Valentine's Day, perfect time to watch it. We're also going to have a marathon if you want to just watch it all in one sitting on February 18th.
It's a great series. I'm glued to it. So many big names attached to this makes it a lot of fun. So congrats on that. What else is coming up?
Also, we have a collection of movies by Black creators. We're calling it Black Excellence. It's for Black History Month. We got a little bit of everything from nostalgic classics like Do the Right Thing and House Party to modern masterpieces like Moonlight and Pariah. So definitely check it out if you have time this month.
All great movies. Listen, Emily, thank you so much. Remember, all month long on Hollywood Suite, check them out. Well, we're deep into mid-season, folks, and CTV sure has their share of what's new and of interest this winter. Have you been watching Night Court? Now, I wasn't sure about this reboot, but it's a wonderful surprise. It's great to see original cast member John Larroquette hasn't lost his edge or comedy chops. And seeing him back on that old courtroom set, well, something very comforting about that. Plus, the show's pretty damn funny. Speaking of familiar faces, Milo Ventimiglia from This Is Us is back in the new drama, The Company You Keep. This time, he's all spiffed up in a tux, playing a con man who unexpectedly falls for a CIA agent. Not Dead Yet is a series I'm intrigued by. Gina Rodriguez from Jane the Virgin stars as a woman returning to a newsroom only to be handed a dead-end job, writing obits. Damned if she doesn't start seeing dead people. Just three of the new shows to get into this winter on CTV. All right, I'm speaking with Peter Raymond, the president of White Pine Pictures, for over 40 years, providing fantastic documentaries on all kinds of very interesting subjects. Right now, Buffy St. Marie, Carry It On, and Unloved, Huronia's Forgotten Children. Congratulations on several Canadian Screen Award nominations on both of those, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Bill. Yeah, they're both beautiful films. I was the executive producer of them, so I can say that. I'm not the director, but they're Buffy is nominated for 5 CSAs and Unloved for 4, both for Best Direction of a Documentary.
Tell me a bit about Buffy St. Marie. What is she like?
She is the nicest famous person I've ever met. She is so, and maybe it's because she lives in Hawaii. She's away from the stress and the glamour and the glitz and the pressures of LA and New York. And she lives there in a farm with her goats. And she's very, you know, of the earth and with the earth. She's
wow.
A lovely, lovely person.
And the writer of some pretty incredible songs, right? People don't realize, perhaps, right?
Well, of course, the anthem of the Stop the Vietnam War, Universal Soldier, that we all sang back in the 60s. And When It's Time for You to Go, the beautiful love song that Elvis made famous. And then Up Where We Belong, which won the Oscar for Best Song. She was the first Indigenous person to win an Oscar in any category.
Wow. I had no idea that she wrote that number. That's pretty amazing. Yeah. Incredible. Well, all right, let's get right to it. The CBC, we want to talk about the future of the public broadcaster, and people have all kinds of ideas, but this concept of perhaps a commercial free CBC is one I think you want to address, right?
Well, I think it's essential. It used to be commercial free, of course, in the old days. And you can't put on a sensitive documentary like Unloved, which is about people being abused sexually and physically in an institution for disabled children, and then interrupt it 5 times with 3 minutes of commercials for, you know, pet food and fancy cars and all sorts of stuff. It just
Dr. Ho.
Oh, it's just wrong. It's wrong. And yeah. But I, you know, and I know it's not CBC executives that are to blame. It's the lack of funding by the government for the public television. Canada is the third lowest in the world of funding of public television per capita. Only Portugal and New Zealand, and I guess the United States, are lower. It's like $30 per person or something in Canada per year that goes towards the funding of the CBC. It's crazy. I think Canadians deserve more. I think Canadians want more quality public television, and they want it without commercials. I mean,
certainly the only reason it's lower in the States is there's 380 million Americans, right?
And PBS is funded a lot by corporations. As you know, when you watch Frontline or any of those shows, we just had our Buffy film on American Masters, and you have, you know, presented by, and you have corporate sponsors, the Annenberg Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, et cetera, et cetera. We don't have that corporate funding of public television in Canada. We have a corporate funding of the arts. The National Arts Center, the ballet, the opera, the etc. are funded by corporations in Canada, but not public television. And I think there's room for a hybrid model here. Until the government wakes up and gives the CBC the money it needs to broadcast commercial free, certainly in prime time commercial free, certainly documentaries and news broadcasts should be commercial free. But until that happens, I suggest, you know, you get a Bank of Montreal or whomever. There are a lot of very wealthy corporations in this country.
Yeah.
To you know, Sunday night could be Sunday night specials. That's where they had Unloved the other night, our film, Huronia, on Sunday night, all through with commercials all through it. Let a corporation sponsor that evening, you know, a 2-hour slot for specials. They could be a documentary. They could be a feature film without commercials, brought to you by whatever. And here's the film. No commercial interruptions. I think it would be great for the corporation, for their profile, great for the CBC, great for the filmmakers who are watching their films being interrupted all the time, and great for the private broadcasters, because they would soak up that that advertising revenue that's not going into the CBC for that slot, and they would have it for their own broadcasts.
Yeah, I think I mentioned to you, I spoke with Barbara Williams, the SVP at CBC, formerly at Global, who in her former career, very much involved in commercial broadcasting, and suggested that something along the, not that idea is better, but just, you know, can you do go commercial free? She seemed very reluctant to abandon $200 million in revenue. And I can understand that. But I like your idea about prime time and news programming. At that would be the way to start. But then you've got...
Sorry to interrupt, Bill, but some of our documentaries and others are funded in part by corporations. It's no editorial control, totally hands off. I went for 2 years and worked at WGBH in Boston on a series called The Nuclear Age, and the Annenberg Foundation put up several million dollars. They were totally hands-free. They never looked at a rough cut or talked to us. We never met anybody. Neither did our executive producers. It was just corporate funding for public television. And that's the model I think we could start to look at the CBC.
Yeah, no, it's a great idea. Just so people are clear, the appropriation that the CBC receives, and this is a football that's kicked up and down Canadian main streets at election time, is I think about 1.2 something million a year or billion. Now, the problem there is people see that number and they think, oh my goodness, but that's divided four ways, French and English and TV and radio right across Canada. So really the TV portion of that is like, I don't know, $600 or $700 million perhaps. TV is a very expensive business, so that money doesn't go as far as you would think, right?
That's right, and they're broadcasting in Aboriginal languages. I mean, I think CBC Radio is terrific, and I think most Canadians would agree. It's television that's the problem with all these commercials. No, they've got infrastructures, they've got towers, they've got buildings.
Yeah, yes,
so that's not going into programming all that money. That's for sure.
Yeah.
So something has to be done. It's just not right to show quality films, documentaries, dramas, news programs, current affairs programs with commercials all through it. It's just not right.
Yeah, it's a great point, Peter. Thank you. You know, you've got, of course, the leader of the opposition. I'm pretty much speaking to his base saying, I'm going to get rid of the CBC. You know, this sword's been dangling over the head of the public broadcaster for many, many years. Do you think he'd ever would act on that?
And that was said in Ontario, you know, during several governments concerning TV Ontario, and people like Peter Herndorf fought that off. But I think if you ask Canadians, if you poll Canadians, if they'd like to keep the CBC,
right,
and if they'd like it to be ad-free in prime time, I think you'd have an overwhelming response positive, no matter what you're hearing from the leader of the opposition.
And then you've got the president of the CBC, Catherine Tate, recently quoted saying, our future's digital. And I mean, that's not a shocker. Everybody's in televisions is, but that there, she foresees a time when it's all digital, maybe in 10 years. Would that change things in terms of funding or make things better or worse? Or any thoughts on...
I don't know. I doubt that it will ever go completely digital. But you know, I'm in the production business.
Right.
I produce and direct documentary films, TV drama series. So whether you're watching it on your cell phone or on your television via the internet or via your satellite or cable, it's the programming that I produce and that I care about, and it really doesn't matter how people are receiving it, and the law was, I think, be an appetite for quality programming
for sure. And if you're I'm just saying, if people are listening, do not watch Icebreaker, the 72 Summit series, on your phone. You want a big screen. That's an awesome, there's so much beautiful photography and historic footage from the Canada-Russia series that you don't want to see that on a 4-inch screen.
No, and the same goes for a lot of quality documentaries now, you know, who are more and more, which are more and more being produced with big music, effects, quality cinematography, drone footage, etc. You know, you're seeing these films much, much better on the big screen and as often as possible. And people are still going to theaters to watch films and document. You have in Toronto the documentary, the Hot Docs, Ted Rogers
Cinema,
Theater, and people go there in droves and watch documentaries all year round, not just during the festival.
Peter, I appreciate you taking so much time. Thank you very, very much. Continued success with everything involved with.
Thanks for having me on. We could talk forever about documentary filmmaking in Canada and the arts, and I appreciate you chatting with me today.
Well, it does seem like a great, great time for documentaries. So continued success with all the wonderful works you have been making and I will be making. And thank you very, very much, Peter, for the time today.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
Thanks a lot.
A fiery horse with the speed of light, a cloud of dust, and a hearty Hi-Yo Silver. The Lone Ranger.
Hi-Yo Silver! Away!
With his faithful Indian companion Tonto, the daring and resourceful masked rider of the plains led the fight for law and order in the early West.
Return with us now to those thrilling days of yesteryear. I'm speaking, of course, about the theme to The Lone Ranger, Peter Raymont's all-time favorite TV theme. The Cowboy series, which premiered on ABC in 1949, starred Clayton Moore as the masked Avenger, with Brantford, Ontario's Jay Silverheels as his Indian companion, Tonto. The theme song dated back to the 1930s when The Lone Ranger was a sensation on radio. Actually, it dated back way before that. The William Tell Overture was the 39th and final opera composed by Rossini, and it premiered in 1829. My thanks again to Peter Raymont, a very accomplished gentleman I've long admired. Thanks as always to Ace Podcast producer Phil Hong, who had to listen to the William Tell Overture over and over and over again to get it just right. Thanks to the many network and studio publicists who bring great guests to this podcast. Please like, subscribe, review, tell your friends, and just generally help spread the word about these conversations with those who make the television we love. I'm Bill Brio. Thanks for listening.